From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The comedian Joan Rivers once quipped, "Money can't buy you happiness, but it can pay for the plastic surgery." Once the realm of Hollywood actors and rock stars, plastic surgery is now mainstream. And if local ads are any indicator, Utahns love tight tummies, sculpted thighs, and another procedure. A recent billboard on I-15 featured two lemons next to two melons. You do the math. With the highest number of plastic surgeons per capita in the nation, why are we so vain? What is it about Utah society that accepts and even encourages a little nip and tuck? Today on the program, plastic surgery. Plus, a new study shows young people are having a tough time landing jobs, which is hurting Utah's young families. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Drive along I-15, and you can't miss the billboards advertising enlargements and sculptings and skin treatments. Those ads and the highest number of plastic surgeons per capita in the nation indicate that Utahns love plastic surgery. So, who is fueling the demand, and what does this quest for beauty say about Utah culture? Today on the program, we're talking about plastic surgery in Utah, and joining me this hour is Dr. Lauren Florence. She's a board-certified plastic surgeon who's been in private practice in Salt Lake City since 1991. She's a member of many organizations, including the Utah Medical Association, the Utah Plastic Surgery Society, and is founder of the Healthcare Information Initiative of Utah. And Dr. Florence is here in studio. Dr. Florence, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Also with us this hour, Dr. Justine Reel. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Health Promotion and Education at the University of Utah. She has a PhD in sport and exercise psychology, and her research interests include body image issues. And Dr. Reel is joining me by phone from her office at the University of Utah. Dr. Reel, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Later on in the program, why young people are struggling to find jobs here in Utah, a new report from Voices for Utah Children explains. But first, improving on Mother Nature. Have you had an eye lift or an augmentation? What was your motivation, and would you do it again? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We do have the highest number of plastic surgeons in Salt Lake City per capita in the nation. It's 6 per 100,000 people. That's more per capita than New York, Florida, even Hollywood. And I guess there is an assumption that there's quite a demand for these services here. I guess my first question is for you, Dr. Florence. How's business?
It's slowed down a little due to the economy, but it's puttering along.
According to the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, procedures are up nationally. Why do you think surgeries, I mean, you've had a bit of a lull due to the economy, but they're still there. There's still patients hungry for these procedures. Why?
Yes, there are. I think the first thing is that we have a training center here in Salt Lake. The wonderful University of Utah gives us 2 plastic surgeons every year. They have 6 in their program, and we just keep churning them out. They stay here because they love it here. Take a look around. It's gorgeous. Lots to do. Lots to stay healthy, exercise, be outside. Skiing is the best in the world, probably. So they if they come from here, they want to stay. If they come from out of town and come and take a look at it, I think they want to stay. Then we have a wonderful patient population. I think they start out beautiful with excellent tissue. A plastic surgeon, well, any surgeon, wants to see somebody who doesn't smoke cigarettes. So we have that, a very low kind of illness quotient. So we have all these healthy, wonderful people who want to continue to look good, and a high concentration because they want to live here.
Who is getting these procedures? Primarily women, men?
A whole range of people. It has been in the past more women, but men are starting to realize that how they look matters not only to themselves but to others as well.
It's interesting to me because Utah is known as such a young state. We have the youngest median age of anywhere in the nation. I think it's under 30. It's 29 or something. if we're so young, why all the plastic surgery? I mean, don't you leave the facelift till you're sagging?
Well, your hormones start to change at about 40. So between 40 and 50, you look in the mirror and, oh my goodness, I, who used to be a natural beauty, needed no makeup, could just get up and run, and surrounded by all these youthful sorts, you look in the mirror and you're not that anymore. But you could be. So there's this internal push to look as good as you can look.
Dr. Real, I want to talk about the sort of the psychosocial dynamics here of this trend. 30 years ago, plastic surgery was something of a taboo subject.
Sure.
But now, seems like everybody's doing it. Maybe you can walk us through some of the changes that you've seen.
Yeah, well, about 10 years ago, I did a study that was looking at women across the lifespan, specifically women who are 20 to 80 years of age. And I found that women that were 40 to 60 had the highest levels of body dissatisfaction and the highest motivation to change their appearance. And, you know, interestingly enough, many of them, if not the majority of them, were very willing to have some type of cosmetic surgery if they had the financial means to do it. So they really didn't see it as a lot of barriers. They just saw it as one more tool to change their appearance closer to what they considered the ideal. And, you know, I think in terms of bringing it home in terms of Salt Lake City and Utah, I think a lot of what has already been mentioned, looking around, seeing youthful folks, 50 being the new 30, and trying to look like one's friends and acquaintances and continuing to stay youthful even as one is aging, you know, I think it's seen as more and more accessible. Many of the procedures are now outpatient, and, you know, women and men are seeing this as just one more way that they can improve themselves.
But what does the research show? As plastic surgery becomes much more common and socially acceptable, Dr. Real, do you see patients in their 20s, in their 30s, before things really start to sag?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I see people on the other end, the mental health side, that, you know, they go in for their dermatologist, for example, and they're looking to have a mole removed. And the dermatologist says, hey, you know, you're starting to have, you know, some wrinkles on your forehead. Why don't you use some proactive strategies like Botox to take care of those? Or, you know, we have a laser procedure that you can use that will keep you looking youthful. And so it's sold to the client as a way to remain youthful and to take care of oneself.
We're speaking with Dr. Justine Real. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Promotion and Education at the University of Utah. Also with us, Dr. Lauren Florence, a board-certified plastic surgeon in practice since 1991. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255 is our number. Dr. Florence, I've heard a fair bit about the mommy makeover. Tell us what the mommy makeover is and why it's so common here in Utah.
I'm not quite sure what that is.
Okay.
I mean, I'm guessing it's work that a mom would have done. Is that what we're talking about?
What I've heard is that it's, you know, tummy tuck. It's fixing all of the things that after you have a child need fixing.
Yes, your stomach stretches with the baby inside. So that skin usually comes back in a young person. But as we age, the elastic fibers get deranged in a way that makes the skin not come back to flat. Or if the expansion during pregnancy was too fast, the dermis tears underneath. The epidermis is still intact, but the dermis underneath, torn, creates a stretch mark. So those stria don't ever heal. The dermis doesn't come back together after that stretch. So that skin should probably be removed. Imagine sitting down. You can take a big pinch of tissue below your belly button. All that can be gone in a abdominoplasty, or the more common word for it, tummy tuck.
Are those among the more common procedures that you see in your practice?
The most common procedure, because I have focused my practice, is plumping up places that are flatter. Now, one of the things that a mother might see after years is loss of fullness in the cheeks and the lips, and all that tissue then kind of droops downward. You can pull it back, as we have in the past, but I think better to make it project forward as it did as a youthful person. Look at kids. Their lips pout out. Their cheeks are big round apples. They have a fuller brow than an old person. All of that indicates age because it's flattened. I can take fat from places that you don't want it and put it back in with a small blunt cannula into places that you do want it. So with almost no scars, you can be re-sculpted. That's my focus.
Dr. Real, is there anything inherently wrong about changing the way you look? I mean, we see people dyeing their hair all the time, getting their nails done. Why is plastic surgery any different, or is it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I founded a group here on campus called SPEAK, Students Promoting Eating Disorder Awareness and Knowledge. And taken to the extreme, small little behaviors, whether it's, you know, restricting food or dieting or skipping lunch or changing one's body through exercise that maybe becomes over-exercise, or becoming obsessed with surgery where an individual is using financial, you know, means that they don't have for procedures. You know, I think it comes down to, is it being taken to the extreme, and what is the motivation behind wanting to change oneself? And the group that I have on campus, our goal is to promote a healthier relationship with food, exercise, and self. And if that person is going forward and making life decisions where, you know, this is something that they want to do for themselves, and they are accepting themselves, you know, that can be really different than somebody who is constantly looking to change oneself and having a certain level of insecurity that's driving, you know, the behaviors. I think what concerns me a little bit is when I hear about, you know, the procedures that are discussed, it sounds almost like a menu. You know, here's your menu on how to become young again. And what happened to just celebrating wherever you are in the life process? You know, I'm about to turn 40, and, you know, should I be concerned about the wrinkles, or should it just be part of the aging process, you know, a natural part of the process? So I think, you know, it does become a concern, you know, from a research and from a practical standpoint as a mental health practitioner, the mental side of things or the attitude that someone takes when they're trying to change or manipulate their appearance.
Dr. Florence, I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
I honor your work, Dr. Real. This sounds exactly what we should be doing, just what we should be doing. Paying attention to the motivation and what is inside of each person who wants change. Because a desire for change can, as you have said, come from something negative, or it can come from something positive. I give myself at least an hour to talk to someone and hear who they are and where they're coming from and what it is that they want before I commit to any kind of major change. I go home sometimes and my husband says, "Who did you talk out of surgery today?" Like, only the people who shouldn't be having it. Because you're right. They have to be healthy and stable and solid coming into it, like themselves, and then want to go to the next step, like exercise and eat well. Those kind of motivations are in a continuum, as I see it, of body image changes.
As Dr. Real points out, there does seem to be a progression. You start with a Botox and then you kind of graduate to more invasive procedures. Is mm-hmm. that your experience, Dr. Florence? Have you seen repeat patients who take that first little step and then they become, I don't know, somewhat obsessed?
Oh, hey, I like this. This looked good. Yeah, let's do, is there something I can do about this? So that's my conversation with them. What don't you like? And why don't you like it, and what have you done to improve yourself in that special vein, and then what I can do. It is a menu. These are the things I can do for that thing you don't like. But they have to be clear what they don't like and why they don't like it, and realize also the limitations of what I can do. Because if someone doesn't like something, doesn't like themselves, they aren't going to like the surgery. The surgery will not help if they're unhappy.
In 2007, Forbes magazine wrote a piece labeling Salt Lake City as the vainest city in America, just based on the number of plastic surgeons that are here.
Did he look at the rest of the people here? They're gorgeous. We have a population that is on the major side, mostly really attractive people. And when you start looking in the mirror and going, oh, I'm not that natural beauty anymore. I have to wear makeup. I didn't used to have to. I have to pay attention to my clothes, how they fit. I used to just throw them on because we're attractive here and healthy. And that makes a huge difference.
Dr. Real, vanity or something else?
You know, I think it still is a national trend, and we may be targeted because of the number of surgeons that we have in the area. I do agree with some of the comments and explanations for why that may be the case as well. But certainly, I mean, it also, in addition to having the highest number of surgeons, we also have three eating disorder treatment facilities here in the state, which is higher, you know, triple the number that we have in other states. And so we have other, you know, a huge emphasis placed on appearance. And it's coming out in many ways, whether it be eating disorders or whether it be electing for cosmetic surgery.
We're talking about Salt Lake City's reputation as the vainest city in America. With us this hour, Dr. Justine Real is an associate professor in the Department of Health Promotion and Education at the University of Utah. Also with us, Dr. Lauren Florence, plastic surgeon here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Why do you think so many Utahns indulge in plastic surgery? Tell us about your experience going under the knife or the laser. 801-355-TALK is our number. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. There are 6 plastic surgeons for every 100,000 people in Salt Lake City. So what's with all the plastic surgery here? You can share your theories. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Joining me this hour, Dr. Lauren Florence is a board-certified plastic surgeon who's been in practice in Salt Lake City since 1991. She's here in studio, and also with us, Dr. Justine Real, an assistant professor in the College of Health at the University of Utah. Can we talk a little bit about the psychological points of this? Before the break, Dr. Real, you were talking about self-esteem issues that are related, and health conditions that are related to low self-esteem, like eating disorders. You suggest that there is a connection to this emphasis that's placed on physical beauty. I guess my question is, the research does seem to be split, that there is, for those people who are not mentally ready for this kind of transformation, it does result in depression and all sorts of other issues that are related to their mental illness. On the flip side, there is research to indicate that plastic surgery can improve your self-esteem, make you feel better about yourself, improve your interactions with other people. Maybe you can talk about that dichotomy, Dr. Real.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the people who do research, you know, in the field that I do, are very anti-surgery and anti-changing yourself in any way. And I think we have to be careful because we don't want to judge anyone for the choices that they make. At the same time, you know, I think it really does come back to what is the mindset of the individual? Are they being adequately screened for mental disorders, depression, mood, anxiety, and, you know, are there eating disorders involved? Are they at a place where they can handle whatever the change is, whether the change is larger than they had anticipated or not as much of a leap as they were hoping for? Are they trying to look like someone else, you know, that isn't realistic? And, you know, is there anything that they can do in terms of their own introspective work where they can work on accepting themselves wherever they are at that moment and in that place, you know, that would not require surgery? And so I think kind of looking at the full picture and, you know, as I was mentioning, kind of looking at developing, having a healthier relationship with food and exercise would be a really important piece.
Dr. Florence, you mentioned that you counsel with patients for at least an hour prior to any, you know, agreement.
Absolutely.
What are the red flags for you as a doctor to see that, you know, maybe plastic surgery is not the answer for you?
Well, if they don't get any exercise, if they don't pay attention to their diet, if they aren't working to be healthy, that's a huge red flag. I so honor what Dr. Real does because you help them get better. I make them look different, but you make them feel and be different, and I just think that's wonderful. So I try to make sure that I'm not going to hurt someone by taking on more than I can actually handle. I handle the superficial. And if they feel better, it's because they already had a good attitude. Screening is all important.
And so, do you find that your colleagues in the field are doing enough of that when people come in? And
you know, they might not be quite as sensitive. When I finished medical school, the dean interviewed us each as we left. And she said to me, now most people I tell to be more sensitive. You, I want you to kind of put on a little bit more of a carapace. You feel too much. And I'm like, okay, so if I feel what the patients feel, partly because they could be me, I'm sitting across from what possibly could be me had I not had this education. So I don't want to hurt them or make them feel worse in any way. I want them to feel better. And maybe there are people who don't have that. Sometimes it's a weakness, sometimes it's a strength, but it's a sensitivity to who is across the table from me.
Dr. Lauren Florence is a plastic surgeon in Salt Lake City. Also with us, Dr. Justine Real, assistant professor in the College of Health at the University of Utah. There does seem to be a laser clinic on pretty much every corner these days. I guess I'm unclear. Is this plastic surgery, and who can perform these procedures? And
oh, the law says that a doctor has to do it. Be
okay.
There.
Okay. So, laser surgery is a plastic surgery.
I think anything a plastic surgeon does is surgery. I mean, even just injections matter. So that's that Juvederm or all the hyaluronic acids that come off of the shelf. And people inject that, you have to know what you're doing to be able to make that look good. Luckily, if it doesn't look good, it goes away in a year or so. So it's not a permanent deformity. But everything that we do requires a sensitivity and an attention to anatomical strength and shapes. Because if you put it in a place that doesn't look quite right, well, there's not a human face looking back out then. You have to make it so that it's the way the maker did it. Only a little, just come back in time. So there's an actual rejuvenation instead of something odd and not good.
Do you think your industry is adequately regulated? I think we've all seen these horror pictures online of really awful procedures that have been done. Do you think that enough is being done to protect consumers by the medical establishment?
I think that there are things that go wrong. I agree that there are some horror stories. And when I've investigated them closely, they're not board-certified plastic surgeons. There are people who have done 6 months of training and then call themselves something like a cosmetic surgeon or something like MD, but not really completely trained. And there's a control from our society to try to maintain those standards that sometimes things pass through and around that aren't actually board-certified plastic surgeons doing the work.
Let's talk about the economic side of this. There was a plastic surgeon here in Salt Lake City, Dr. York Yates, perhaps you know him, who wrote a piece online that 20% of his clients are coming from out of state. And he suggests that maybe it's because plastic surgeries here are a lot cheaper than elsewhere.
There is a Medicare formula that defines how much Medicare will pay for procedures.
Medicare pays for plastic surgery?
No, but this is then translated into payments for all care. Mm. And within that formula that Medicare has is a geographic number. Mm. And so the multiplication for how much Medicare pays, which is then translated into how much other care is paid for, which then is sort of used as a baseline for plastic surgical costs. The geography is that we get paid about half as much in Utah as in Idaho, and about a third as much in Utah as in Nevada. So if someone sees how much it costs in Nevada and then just across the state line in Utah, it costs less, they may be coming here for that. I think that's not a good idea. Who takes care of you when you're not home? You had a surgical procedure and you're not within your network of support. And I don't think that's right. I think that we should be close to home when we have such an invasive thing done to us.
Again, we're speaking with Dr. Lauren Florence and Dr. Justine Reel about plastic surgery here in Utah. I'm curious, Dr. Reel, you know, we have shows on TV like Nip Tuck on HBO and this Fox reality show, The Swan. Talk about the role that media plays in this trend of plastic surgery.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the media, with the shows, you know, even Biggest Loser, you know, where it's all focused on changing instead of accepting your natural body shape, size, and weight and being healthy at any size, it creates a mentality where we're constantly looking to fix something, fix our flaws, and scrutinize our body. You know, and look for the things that we can do to change or maintain our body. I think one of the things that's a concern is when we do have the laser clinics that look like spas, people are going in just like they would to have their nails done just for their weekly or monthly maintenance fix-up. And so I think the media feeds it as well as people are rewarded with attention, you know, for, you know, undergoing pretty extensive procedures to change themselves.
But I guess the question is, if you are a healthy individual and you want to improve, why not? Why not make a change? Why not lose 10 pounds? Why not, you know, lift or take the fat out of your eyebrows, lift certain things? Dr. Reel, what's the problem with that?
I think it all comes down to lifestyle. You know, what's wrong with the alternative, which is developing a healthy lifestyle that supports maintaining a healthy weight for yourself so that you're not constantly losing weight and then gaining it back, or, you know, that you're able to eat the foods that you want in moderation, or you're able to exercise and listen to your body and really use an intuitive approach to both your physical activity as well as your nutrition, and then look at the mirror and be happy with what you see staring back at you, but not developing an obsession about changing yourself constantly.
What about the role that our peers have in all of this? Here in Utah, there are many people who have close-knit girlfriends and neighbors, and there is a pressure to, I would say, to keep up appearances. What have you seen here, Dr. Real, in terms of those influences and, you know, self-esteem?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, the friends, looking good for friends, trying to, bunco night and trying to, you know, have a good appearance, you know, as you're out with friends. Also, you know, trying to look good for potential dating partners. The other thing I thought of as we were speaking earlier is, you know, the influence of mothers and fathers who are receiving cosmetic surgery, and then their children are seeing this as just a natural progression of age.
Dr. Florence, is this a family affair? Do you see generations coming through your door?
I actually do. First off, I continue to honor what Dr. Real says. I think that she is totally correct in the way that she's approaching this, and is a very good guide for most people's behavior. But imagine someone without a chin, just was born with a small mandible, and so there's a sort of a chinless look, kind of a froggy face. The daughter, well, the granddaughter of a patient that I had worked on didn't have a chin. She sings and sounds like an angel. She applied to Juilliard and got in the finals, but then didn't make it to get into Juilliard. We put some fat in her chin and did a little liposuction under her chin, so now she has a more prominent jaw, which is a change in the way she looks. Although she was beautiful, she's now on stage, she's been admitted to a program. Did it make a difference? Well, maybe it only made a difference to her, but it made a difference somehow, because she does feel amazingly better and bounces into my office where she used to sort of slink in. I don't know why. Maybe it's because of the change that she had. I hope it is. And maybe it's because Grandma said, we can do something about this. Because Grandma knew. She grew up in Hollywood and brought the granddaughter to me. So yes, it does have an influence. But there's more. We didn't even touch on what the local religious concept of eternal progression might be doing to our minds.
Okay.
You progress through your life and then through eternity, getting better and better and better.
So you want a body to match that?
Well, I don't know if you can't take your body, but they talk about, I mean, the word eternal progression is in the sort of local concept. So perhaps there is something about you learn it at Sunday school and then you get it at home and progress forever.
Dr. Real, is there something about Mormon culture and this, ongoing search for perfection that has something to do with our body image?
When we look at traditional gender roles, we see an intersection, you know, with higher focus on appearance, a tendency to, you know, spend more time with beauty maintenance. And so thinking about, you know, if there are those traditional gender roles and if that's, you know, pretty important, presenting a more feminine appearance or a more masculine appearance to stay in line with the gender roles, I think that would certainly fit. But I would also say, in terms of the Mormon culture, that there's, you know, an emphasis on health and fitness. And so I don't think it would necessarily have to be, completely focused on beauty, but just taking care of yourself.
We're running low on time. But this question, finally, for both of my guests, is plastic surgery just a fad? Again, 30 years ago, this was not a mainstream activity. Or has it become more of a fixture in our society? Dr. Florence?
Well, for instance, if someone had a horrible scar and had a skin graft put on that scar, that we will always do. The plastic surgeons have been making people look better since the Civil War. It can get out of hand. We've seen the horrors. But I think that the basic, we make people better looking and thus they feel better, will persist.
Dr. Real, does plastic surgery make people feel better?
Well, I was just going to say, I don't think it always does make them look better, if it doesn't make them look like themselves. But in some cases, you know, individuals are choosing to engage in plastic surgery. And in terms of the emphasis on appearance, that has been there, and that's nothing new. And it's just the ideal that's shifted over time. So our cultural expectation of what we should look like has changed. And so we've always had something that we're striving for, and what it is has changed and evolved, and the methods that we're using to try to get there, you know, have evolved with that.
Dr. Justine Real, an assistant professor in the College of Health at the University of Utah. Dr. Real, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Dr. Lauren Florence, plastic surgeon here in Salt Lake City. Dr. Florence, thanks to you.
Time well spent. Thank you.
Up next, employing the state's young people, a new report by Voices for Utah Children. But first, a quick break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. The Great Recession has hit Utah's young people particularly hard. A new report by the child advocacy group Voices for Utah Children shows that high unemployment is leading more of Utah's young families into poverty. And joining me now with the details of the study is Allison Rowland. She's the Director of Research and Budget at Voices for Utah Children. And Allison Rowland joins me here in studio. Dr. Rowland, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, for the invitation.
And we invite you to join the conversation as well. Are you in your 20s? Are you struggling to find a job or to make ends meet? Give us a call, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Allison Rowland, the Great Recession has affected Utahns across the board, but you argue that young workers have been hit particularly hard. Maybe give us the numbers on that. What's the data?
That's absolutely right, Jennifer. You know, as we were developing this report, we take a look overall at workers in Utah, and we realized that there's a very stark difference between older and younger workers. Right now, the unemployment rate in Utah is about 7.4%. For young workers, that is, workers between 16 and 24 years of age, the average unemployment for 2010 was 14.7%, so about double the rate of workers overall in Utah. At the same time, we've got a lot of workers who have not even entered the workforce. They have graduated from high school or college. In better economic conditions, they might be looking for a job. But many of them have realized there just aren't that many jobs out there.
So is that what's going on? There's just not jobs available?
Well, there's a real contrast, because certainly there are jobs. Certainly most Utahns who want to be working are working, and that's a very good thing. On the other hand, there is a group of people who typically are getting their best work experience, their first work experience in these younger years, and they are not getting into the labor force. You know, in the past, about 72% of workers between age 16 and 24 have been employed. Excuse me, that's actually 66% of workers. So two-thirds of workers, young workers, have been employed. During the recession, that has dropped all the way down to 56%. So only about half of all the people aged 16 to 24 in Utah who would like to be, who are eligible to be in the workforce, are working. But that's down from two-thirds in 2007.
I see. It's interesting. The conventional wisdom has been that the older workers would have the trouble finding and landing a job, as opposed to the younger workers who employers can pay less. So why the change? Or, you know, what's going on here?
I mean, unfortunately, I wish I could say things are great for older workers. They're not. But what we have in Utah is this particular demographic structure where we have more young workers, more young people in general, and relatively fewer older people in the workforce. So certainly there are real problems for older people who may be out of a job today and who may have a harder time getting back into the workforce. But the real big numbers, the real base of the population pyramid is in this, these 16 to 24-year-old workers, for which we have thousands, tens of thousands, who are eligible to enter the workforce each year. We estimate about of the 44,000 or so people in Utah who turn 16 every year, about 25,000 of them are looking for work, or would be interested in jobs if they were available. So that means that there's just such a big number of them, they're overflowing into the, there are too many of them for the number of jobs who are that are available for low-skilled, low-experienced workers, which are typically the 16 to 24-year-olds. The other point that's important is this question of experience, because, of course, an older worker tends to have more experience. If you can go with a younger worker who may be maybe going to school part-time, may have young kids in the household, or with an older worker who's more seasoned, who may seem more serious, who may seem more, who has more experience than a younger worker, many employers are going to go with those older workers. So younger workers are losing out.
Mm. We're speaking with Allison Rowland. She's the Director of Research and Budget at Voices for Utah Children, and we're talking about a new report showing that young Utah workers are having a hard time getting a job. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. And let's go to the phones, and Braxton is with us from, I believe it's Salt Lake City. Braxton, welcome.
Thanks.
Go right ahead.
Well, I just called in because I work at a coffee shop. I'm 23 years old and a full-time student, and I've been working pretty much since I was 16. I'm originally from New York, but I found that, you know, pretty much as hard as it's been to find a job, it's a matter of spending every minute of every day, you know, peppering everywhere with your resume and with job applications, and I see kids every day just complaining about the horrible job market who just sit around and aren't really making much of an effort to get a job.
Mm. Do you think that jobs are out there then?
I do. I think that they're probably really difficult to find. I haven't had the easiest time myself, but, you know, I find work somehow.
You say you're working in a coffee shop. Are you working full-time?
I work about 30 hours a week.
And would you like a full-time position?
Actually, I'm a full-time student right now, so it's tough to balance even that.
Braxton, thanks very much for the call. Allison Rowland, this seems to reflect a lot of the data that you have collected into this report.
That's right. And I do want to applaud Braxton for his persistence in looking for a job and being able to get it, and also being able to do that balance between full-time school and a 30-hour-a-week job. You know, that's something that historically Utahns have been very good at. Young Utahns have been very good at going to school, paying for school and their own personal expenses with that money. And then also, you know, well, because Utahns tend to start their families earlier than people in other areas of the country, Utahns are also taking care of young children at the same time. It's a very difficult balance, and, you know, it's great to have someone like Braxton who's able to do all those things. It can become more difficult for some people. There are families, for example, if you have to take care of young children, you've got to be able to balance your working hours with the times your children are around the house. If you're a couple, you've got to be able to balance the time you spend at home, the time you spend at work, the time you take care of kids, the time you're in class, the time you're in homework. It's very difficult. And so I think, you know, the bottom line here is, on the one hand, there are jobs out there. It is possible to get jobs. But we shouldn't overlook the fact that there are so many more people right now looking for jobs than there are jobs, that it's going to be very, very difficult.
Braxton, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's now go to Skyler in Salt Lake City. Skyler, hi.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I just wanted to make a quick comment. It is pretty hard. I'm a returning combat veteran. And it took me a little bit to find employment, but I just recently found a new job. And it seems to be more hard, even if you have employment, to get out of this poverty stage. I think it's, you know, I want to say it's part of the reason is because the cost of living is still so high, you know, the cost of gas, the cost of food and everything. And even if you have employment, I couldn't imagine for, you know, people my age that don't have an employment. And it just seems really, really difficult in times like these.
Skyler, thanks a lot for the call. Allison Rowland, in your report, it does point out that even people with jobs, they're still being put in this bracket of poverty, that it's really hard to get ahead when the jobs are there. Your hours may be cut back. You're working part-time. It's tough, as Skyler points out.
That's right, and I appreciate Skyler's call and appreciate his service to the country. It's tough. I mean, I can imagine, too, the dilemma or the difficulty of having come back from combat and doing your best, working hard, and still ending up without enough money to pay the bills. You know, one thing we find in this report is that Utah's wages did grow from about 2000 to about 2010, but that growth was really wiped out by inflation in 2009 and 2010. Remember, we had rising food prices, rising gas prices. That takes a huge cut of any money you may be making. And as a young person, typically, you're making less money than you will later on in your 40s and 50s when you've had a whole, you know, 20, 30 years of experience behind you in the workforce. This other question of poverty is really tragic in a lot of senses. The poverty rate in Utah has risen to 13.2%. That's about 360,000 people in Utah living in poverty. The poverty rate of people who have jobs in Utah is 7.9%. So we're looking at close to 100,000 people in Utah who are working, who still can't make enough money to get beyond the poverty line. The poverty line, just for your information, is about $22,000 for a family of four. The poverty line is very low. If you've tried to, you know, raise a family, two kids, two adults, on $22,000 a year, you can see why you're still struggling if you're only making around $22,000 a year.
Skyler, thanks for that call. 801-355-TALK. I want to squeeze in another call. Miriam is calling from Salt Lake City. Miriam, hi.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Allison. And Allison, I don't know that we've met, but we should. I'm the chair of the Disability Caucus, and I've been getting a lot of calls, especially from parents whose children have turned 18 or 19 but are unable to find work, and they're on Medicaid. And Medicaid assumes that by the time you're 19, you're working, and therefore cuts off your medical benefits. And things are just a mess for them. The parents likely don't have insurance that the children can go on to. And even if they did, the costs are so prohibitive. People are really finding themselves in a bind, and like you said, you know, if you're making $20,000 or $30,000 a year, you're lucky if you can afford rent and utilities.
Miriam, thanks for those thoughts. In the report, Allison, you point out that there will be long-term consequences for these young people who can't get a job because they're not establishing that work experience, and it's going to hinder their wage ability later on in life.
That's right. And, you know, I appreciate Miriam's call because we are concerned about the safety net, about the services that need to be provided, given that so many young people and so many Utahns in general are not going to be able to find a job in the coming months and possibly years. Everybody wants to work. Virtually everyone wants to be a contributing member of society. The problem is that at a certain point, when you can't find that employment, you need to depend on services that are offered to the public to be able to pay your bills. Medicaid is extremely important. CHIP is extremely important. The Family Employment Program offered by the Department of Workforce Services is extremely important in helping people bridge the this gap and helping people really survive during these periods in which they're going to be unemployed. So part of the reason for our report is to encourage lawmakers to understand that these problems are going to be continuing into the future, that unless we get a very strong national recovery, which very few people are predicting, Utahns are going to continue to be suffering from being out of work. And in order to not suffer these effects over the longer term, we really need to invest in young people, make sure that they can continue to support their families, continue to attend college and improve their skills, so that when the economy recovers, they can get right into the workforce and get back on their feet.
Allison Rowland is Director of Research and Budget at Voices for Utah Children. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jennifer.
City Views is a production of KCPW. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.